Crouch backs income tax elimination, the first GOP presidential primary debate, plus a change coming to the Indiana Republican Party, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending August 25th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch, who's running for governor, is backing a push to eliminate the state's individual income tax. That tax currently brings in about $8 billion a year for Indiana, a third of total state revenue. Crouch says she's pushing income tax elimination because she constantly hears from people who are struggling with inflation and the increasingly high cost of living. Making up for the loss of so much revenue, she says, will require a holistic approach.
We're going to look at cutting government spending. We're going to look at limiting government growth. We're going to look at finding efficiencies within government.
What programs or services might be on the chopping block? She won't say. She also won't delve into specifics on how she wants to modernize the tax code as part of her plan.
The how isn't as important as the what. And the what is, we are going to eliminate income tax.
A legislative task force is currently examining the state's entire tax system. Crouch says she'll watch closely the results of that effort. Can Indiana afford to eliminate its state income tax? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwarz, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Elise Schrock, is this a good idea?
Well, it is certainly a flashpan idea coming out of a primary, quite frankly, earlier than I thought something this sweeping would come out. So that's the surprising thing to me, where you've got a crowded primary, it's already been contentious, and already we're throwing something this grand.
Well, I mean, the primary started a lot sooner, I suppose, than the normal.
That is fair.
Adjusted for that.
So, but you've got the politics and the policy side of this, right? So politics, okay, we're all talking about it. The policy side, to not have details about how this would be done, to take $8 billion out of our revenue to that's a whole year of school funding. This isn't something that happens overnight. There's a current committee, the task force, they met this week, that is setting this. You don't just eliminate the income tax. Not to mention, we have spent the last 15 years just focused on tax breaks. If the intention with this is to help families because of high inflation, we should be investing in Hoosier families. We should be switching to a model where we are investing in public health, in public education. We haven't been doing that because we've been so focused on the tax breaks. That's the policy side. On the political side, it's some flashpan politics. We're talking about it, and I think that's the intent.
The how is not as important as the what, and the what is eliminating the state income tax. When you're talking about eliminating $8 billion, and that's just right now, by the time we would actually do this, it will be probably closer to 9 or even 10 if things continue to go well. The how seems pretty important, does it not?
Sure, but we're in the what part right now of the cycle, and we have been investing in all the things that Elise just said, which is why, in part, we are talking about tax cuts again, because we've been awash in kind of an obscene amount of surplus money, a large portion of which they spent down. I'm trying not to revel too much in the fact that the Indiana Democrats and Curtis Hill both agree. At Curtis Hill, the conservative in the race, the so-called conservative in the race, came out and said, how are you going to replace all this revenue? That's not the conservative part of cutting taxes, where we make the government whole. You have to experience pain on government side if you're trying to deliver relief to the people you're trying to deliver relief to in inflationary times. This is very similar to me in the conversation about property taxes. Same dynamic. How are you going to do it? We can never do it. It's too expensive. It's going to hurt too much. Well, you go through that, but it was so necessary because people were losing their homes only because of their property tax bill. And that was back in 2008, and we fixed that problem. But it took a number of – you had to turn a lot of dials to deliver that level of relief and not completely flush or put that much strain on state and local government. So I think the committee that met this week is going to look at all of those options, all of those dials that you turn, and do what my favorite Mitch Daniels line, let's write a tax code like someone designed it on purpose.
I mean, we already have a flat regressive tax, though, when it comes to income tax. This seems like the total elimination
Yeah, to that point, I was going to say, if you wanted to get, you know, she's right. People are struggling. Inflation, high gas prices, high prices at the grocery store. That is a real problem that people are absolutely struggling with. It seems to me that, and if you cut a tax, there is pain on the government side. That's the way it works. Feels like there would be a lot of pain, not just for the government, but for people who count on government services, if you just get rid of this tax. So why not move to a progressive income tax where you are helping people who can't, who need the help more, and the people who don't need as much help would pay in a little bit more?
Well, I guess the problem politically with adopting that kind of proposal is it doesn't get the same kind of bang for your political buck. If that were the case, yeah, we might be talking about it, but it wouldn't be as, wow, now that's a bold proposal. And it's surprising to me. Yes, you would like to see more how in particulars and specifics. That's one thing, but we'll take that off the table for a minute. But if you looked at these candidates that are seeking the job and you said, who ranked them most likely to propose the elimination of the individual income tax? I would have put her maybe not at the bottom for the likelihood, but close to the bottom, because she's someone who has been a champion of government as a force for good in terms of the mental health arena, in terms of the delivery of human services. She chaired a task force, a roundtable that looked at this issue for quite a period of time. These are issues that don't come cheap. The solutions don't come cheap.
We just spent $100 million in the new state budget, and everybody agreed not nearly enough.
Not enough. So that's one thing. It seems like that's hard to reconcile that individual who saw state government as a force for good and for lifting up those who need help, and the notion of improving the quality of life overall. Some things that, more trails, more parks, they don't have a direct cause and effect for the payback, but there's things that only state government can do or government can do that individuals and the private sector can't. That's just the fact.
And
if you sacrifice that, the assumption is, it just seems to me, you adopt this kind of knee-jerk sense that government is bad. It can't be a force for good. It can't be propel change, and therefore we got to cut it to the bone.
And the idea of attracting businesses, and even perhaps more importantly right now, given the state of economic development, people and talent to the state, or keeping them here before they leave, that she believes, you eliminate the state income tax, that's what's going to happen, is more businesses are going to come here, more people are going to come here. But increasingly, what we are told by businesses is that quality of place, the idea of making a place attractive to live and work in, not just to work in, but to live and work in, is the watchword of economic development. If you take away the government's ability to do things like trails and all of these, the important government services and then the quality of place government services, because those are the ones that go first when you're talking about slashing $8 billion, aren't you hurting yourselves with the very thing you think you're trying to solve?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. I give her credit for throwing down, a bold idea for, she's steering the conversation. Yeah. Her other opponents are having to now talk about it. But the details from someone who's covered the nitty-gritty of state budgets are important. And she said, we're not going to raise any additional taxes. So then the idea of, efficiencies, that's what we heard again and again, efficiencies. Look, this kind of cracks me up about this conversation, is Republicans have been in charge for 20 years. Are there billions of dollars of efficiencies still in state government or inefficiencies? And if so, why? Because they've been in charge for 20 years. So acting like you can find billions in efficiencies is just not realistic. And when you cut something, that means someone doesn't get a service, whether it means you have to go to the next county to the DMV or just various ways you interact with state government. So, but I appreciate the conversation. I've said for a long time I want candidates to be making proposals, yes, and let's talk about them. So.
Oh, yeah, this is absolutely
welcome.
Yeah, this
is welcome. A proposal.
Yeah. All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, should Indiana eliminate its individual income tax? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question was, can former Commerce Secretary Brad Chambers make an impact in the GOP gubernatorial primary? 33% of you say yes, 67% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. 8 Republican presidential candidates faced off on a debate stage this week for the first time this cycle, though the frontrunner, Donald Trump, was noticeably absent. Trump chose not to participate in the debate, indicating he had nothing to gain, and he was the target of some criticism from the 8 candidates who did appear on stage in Milwaukee. But the primary target of attacks Wednesday night was businessman Vivek Ramaswamy, who's recently been rising in the polls, and it was former Vice President Mike Pence who frequently clashed with Ramaswamy.
Now is not the time for on-the-job training. We don't need to bring in a rookie. We don't need to bring in people without experience.
At least one post-debate focus group, CNN's, had Ramaswamy winning the debate. Mike O'Brien, are you surprised that Pence and others, I mean, almost everybody, went after Vivek Ramaswamy and not Ron DeSantis?
Yes, but not really because of Ron DeSantis. I mean, he's kind of had his ceiling now for a while, right? So he's stagnated. But they not only did they go after him, they came in prepared to go after him. It wasn't even like he was just, like, outshining them in the moment, and they're like, man, we got to, like, you know, take some shots at this guy and try to even things out.
Yeah,
they came in with canned lines. Chris Christie had the Obama line the last time we had, trying to, like, you know, troll him a little bit on the, you know, being the old brown guy on stage, I guess. And then Nikki Haley did the same thing with Israel, hitting him on Israel. And he was eating it up
the
as
Pence
he's getting
line
attacked.
The Pence line, you know, we don't need a rookie. Yeah. I mean, there was no way he came up with that in the moment. That was that definitely felt
they were
like
all
something
like, yeah. And then he kind of, Ramaswamy kind of called them all on it because they all had these, like, canned lines to go after him. So it's interesting to just watch that and then just try to think about, okay, what are they seeing under the surface that maybe we're not all seeing yet? Or they've been on the trail with this guy and they're like, no, he's got it. So we got to make sure we cool him off a little bit.
And so to that point, is Ramaswamy coming out as maybe the big one of, if not the big winner of this debate?
I mean, for this debate, sure. I mean, if you, no matter what side you're on, if you're scrolling, he's the face that is popping up. And to Mike's point, he was clearly ready for it, and he was taking the any news is good news tactic and just kind of leaned into it. But at the end of the day, they were all saying the same things. They're all trying to out-climate deny each other. They're trying to call for a nationwide abortion ban, and, you know, they were saying a lot of the same things, but as far as, like, who had the most pizzazz, sure, we'll give it to him.
I thought Mike Pence's 15-week baseline proposal surprised me, because he's been so locked into very few exceptions, if any, you know, pretty hard line, and when he came out with that kind of, no, we need a 15, let the states do what they want to do to dial it in, but we need a 15 weeks, what's 75% of Americans support? I liked it. It just surprised me they went that far.
Because Americans are saying, we don't want this.
No, I mean, he's saying 75% of Americans want this. They may not want, what Indiana has, or they may not what other states have.
Maybe took a page out of Kyle Walker's book.
Now, if he had proposed eliminating the personal income tax at the federal level, then we'd be talking, right? Then
we don't care about how we pay for things at the federal
level. That's
true.
Well, that's an attention grabber.
Oh,
that's going to grab your attention.
To that point, how did Mike, you know, feels like Mike Pence needs to make a move, and it felt like he was starting to. He got a lot more attention in the last few weeks, going after Trump a little harder. Did this help? Did this debate performance help Mike Pence?
No, he did not make a move. I mean, he was wanting to get in there. He was attacking. But it almost went overboard, you know, where he was kind of needy and whiny. Why isn't it my turn to speak? He was talking over the bell. He was talking over his opponents. So he was not helped. I do think behind Vivek, I think Nikki Haley probably improved her situation the most. She distinguished herself from her opponents on a few items. I got to tell you, that was one of the most entertaining debates I've watched in a long time. I look forward to the next one.
I wanted to talk about Ron DeSantis quickly. He's seen as the guy. If it's not going to be Trump, it's going to be Ron DeSantis. That's kind of where everybody saw this going for a while. But, you know, Mike made the point. He seems to be stagnating, maybe hitting a ceiling. So arguably, he needed a good performance. Now, nobody attacked him, which is great, but I don't think many people are talking about Ron DeSantis after that debate. Is that a problem for him?
Oh, I think he's not living up to expectations, let's put it that way. And in fact, one of the biggest stories leading up to the debate really sort of boxed him in. It was his own pack, well, a pack that's not technically tied to, in a legal sense, to the candidate, and therefore can't communicate directly, but posted all kinds of advice about strategic approach for this debate, talking about will you label Ramaswamy, you know, Vivek the fake, and then and all, so really, if he'd ever thought about using any of this material, maybe even independent of what this packet said,
no, he couldn't do it.
He couldn't do it, so his hands were tied. Ramaswamy, I think this is the phenomenon we see with, you know, what Procter & Gamble finished and other consumer products manufacturers figured out a long time ago. Put new on the label, and you're going to get some eyeballs. And I think he's going to benefit in the short term. He's different. He looks different. He's fresh. He's different. But he also has that shoot from the hip quality where that he's not accustomed to dealing with it under the scrutiny one receives when one wants to occupy the White House. And so when you talk about abolishing, you know, the FBI, when you talk about ways to control China by arming everybody in Taiwan, I mean, there's some interesting, they don't really, and the conspiracy theories, you know, you get a lot of, he's been hit a lot with, there were federal agents on the planes at 9/11.
It's not like Republicans elected a guy to the White House who fits that description almost exactly correct in 2016, renominated him in 2020, and he's the front runner for 2024. It only seems to work for Donald Trump.
And like with the soap suds in the store, if you try it, you buy it because it's new, but then you try it and it's not working any better, then you may not buy it again.
Kyle, soap suds in the store.
we all buy soap suds in the store. Kyle Hupfer will soon step down as chair of the Indiana Republican Party after more than half a decade leading the political organization.
Hupfer's 6.5 years leading the Indiana GOP makes him the longest-serving head of the state party in more than 20 years. Under his tenure, Republicans took control of every statewide elected position in government. In a statement, Hupfer called his time leading the party a great honor and privilege and touted the gains made by the GOP at the local level. Hupfer will officially step aside once his successor is elected by the party's central committee.
John Schwanes, how important is a state party chair to the party's success?
I still think they're underestimated their value and their worth, especially in a state where having R behind your name, if you go in with straight ticket voting, I mean, it packs a punch. And if you have the organizational heft to help somebody get on a ballot, get signatures, even a high-profile individual who succeeded in the private sector or done something that's garnered headlines through some other endeavor, there's a nitty-gritty of politicking that still somebody's got to do it. And state parties you don't have the clout necessarily they used to. They don't run the licensed branches anymore, and so the revenue stream isn't what it would be. But I think you underestimate their role at your own peril if you're an up-and-coming candidate on both sides of the aisle.
So let's talk about his replacement. So generally speaking, in Indiana, the governor, if that's the party, you know, in control, the governor kind of leads the party. Even if there's a senator in the same party, the governor leads the state party. And so the governor is often the one who says, this is the person I want leading the state party, which makes sense. You want that cohesion there. Eric Holcomb's going to be out of that job here pretty soon, but you need somebody in the interim. Now, he said, I want Anne Hathaway to lead the state party, but that feels like a caretaker position, does it not?
Yeah, it's a really odd timing because normally you would wait till the new governor was elected, and if it's a Republican again, then the new governor would sort of get their person. So, yeah, I don't know.
Which is why Kyle Hupfer was the state party chair.
Yeah, I don't know if it's more of, like you said, a caretaker situation. I mean, I think Anne Hathaway, I don't think she'll have any trouble getting the support of the Central Committee. She's incredibly intelligent, talented. She's been around the state and party politics for years. I don't think she'll have any trouble continuing the success that party has had. But it's very interesting timing, and, I guess we'll see what happens.
Now, reportedly, Hupfer is going to help Brad Chambers in his gubernatorial campaign. We know that the way that, you know, Kyle Hupfer is very well liked among the state party apparatus for obvious reasons. But go outside the state party apparatus, and there's been some unrest over how conservative or not people, Republican primary voters, feel the Republican Party is. Is that going to help Brad Chambers?
I don't know because, I mean, his tenure, the party has changed actually quite a bit. The arguments that are happening internally I mean, from a national side and down to state is not like, oh, should we, you know, it's not about tax breaks. It's not, should we dip into this social issue or not? It's like, do we believe in democracy? And that is how expansive these conversations have become. So whoever steps into that role, like, that is a lot to step into. Wherever he goes, he takes that with him. And this is going to be a pivotal point for the party.
Yeah, to that end, even if it's a kind of caretaker role until presumably a Republican is elected governor in 2024, you're presiding over a party that is overseeing a massive, hugely impactful primary. Now, the state party's not going to come in and say, oh, yeah, this is our pick. Obviously, they're not going to do that for this gubernatorial primary. But how difficult a job is that for whoever takes this position following Kyle?
It's a management position. I've never been state chair, but I've been county chair and a district chair, congressional district chair. And you are going to have pockets of people that there's a lot of friction in these positions, right? Because there's a lot of big egos. There's a lot of people trying to move from this office to that office. And there's people and other people in the way of that. And you're trying to just manage that. Lost to, you know, the record, the electoral record of Kyle under Kyle's tenure speaks for itself. But what a lot of people don't know is our state party was not managed well or in a good position coming out of 2016. The money was almost week to week. The Governor Pence kind of ran his own separate organization. He preferred that over this kind of unified. And Kyle really pulled all that back together and made state party a strong, with a great staff around him, a really strong operation that could drop into and manage campaigns and win historic number of mayoral races that people forget about. So he really deserves credit. Not just for the electoral wins, but the operation that he created and he leaves behind, which will easily carry us through 24.
The Indianapolis Public Schools Board filed a lawsuit this week against State Education Secretary Katie Jenner and other state officials. From WFYI's Education Desk, Eric Weddle reports the suit is over a controversial law that allows charter school organizations to buy closed public school buildings for $1.
This year, policymakers revamped the so-called dollar law and added an exemption. To qualify, a school district must share tax referendum funds with charter schools. IPS says it does just that, sharing millions of dollars with some city charter schools. And now, the district wants to sell two closed school buildings. But Education Secretary Katie Jenner says IPS is not exempt. So IPS filed a lawsuit in Marion County Superior Court. They want a judge to decide if the district is exempt.
Mickey Kelly, has this $1 school policy turned into a bit of a mess?
It's been a mess since it started. I mean, we have tweaked the law and changed the law and tweaked the law. We've had lawsuits back and forth. I think, and you mentioned Bob Boehning, Representative Boehning, he said in session that he wanted to get out of the business. And I think a lot of Republicans are starting to agree with him. It's more trouble than it's worth. And I think it's sunset now. And so we are going to move that way. But in the meantime, we get yet another lawsuit.
Yeah. Are we close to the end of the $1 school policy?
I hope so. I mean, it has taken up a lot of air at the legislature when we have so many more important things to be talking about. Accountability for charter schools being one of them. If we should be talking about accountability over giving them breaks like this. So it's been unpopular. It continues to be unpopular. And yeah.
It hasn't been adjusted for inflation. Should be like $3 at least by now. Three or four.
Yeah, right. I mean, at least the way inflation gone for the last couple of years. Are we close to the end of this policy now?
According to Chairman Boehning, we are. That's where he closed Senate Bill 391 as it was coming through his committee, that he wants to get out of this in the next couple of years, and that's the direction they're heading.
Yeah. All right. Finally, the governor this week marked the official statewide expansion of Dolly Parton's Imagination Library. Now, this is an initiative that provides free books every month for children from birth up to age 5, regardless of income level. It has been a tremendous success in the states it's been used in. Here in Indiana, it was in a little more than half of all counties, but now with statewide buy-in helping support that program, it'll be statewide, all 92 counties. So, Mike O'Brien, what was your favorite book, thinking in that 0 to 5 range as a kid?
Yeah, I was worried that we were going to have a book, and I was going to pick, like, Green Eggs and Ham and look like an idiot. But I was a big Dr. Seuss fan. I hope we don't find out he was, like, a closet communist, and we pull Are You My Mom off the shelves. But, you know, I was always a big fan of
Hamilton East, that'll be the new policy.
That's right.
Favorite 0 to 5 book as a kid?
Shel Silverstein, Where the Sidewalk Ends.
Speaking of communists.
Velveteen Rabbit.
I read all the Corduroy books, and I just love them.
Absolutely great. John?
People joke about it. I actually did have See Dick Run, Chase Jane, Dog, whatever.
Run.
Yeah, it's still on my shelf somewhere. I just got to figure
it out. I asked my mom, like, what was the book that I ran to get the most often? And she said, any of Tommy DiPaola's books, particularly Stregonona.
You're reading this stuff? My goodness.
You can being read to me.
You guys
are being read to me.
I had great eggs in hand in both languages. There was a bilingual version.
I like that, yeah. So I'd say any of the Tommy DiPaola's Stregonona books. My wife, which tells you a lot about my wife, used to read Grimm's Fairy Tales when she was a little kid. And not like the sanitized version, not like the Disneyfied version, like the original, really, really dark Grimm's Fairy Tales. So that was hers. All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at WFYI.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.